It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Well, today it's six mind-altering potables and how they mark human evolution. Our guest is Tom Standish. His book is A History of the World in Six Glasses. Well, our very own root beer connoisseurs, the Sterns, have uncovered smoky aftertastes and hints of frivolity at the Mug and Bun in Indianapolis. Mario Batali talks the Italian way with vegetables. Grilling up a 14-buck-a-pound lamb chop is easy. Real skill is in handling the cheap cuts. Gourmet Magazine's John Willoughby has a cheap lamb primer. Then it's the best ice creams around the country from the Happy Belly Guides. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this. It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Well, today we have six new candidates for the comestible that changed the world, and they're a heck of a lot more fun than cod or salt. It's the history of the world in six glasses by our guest, British journalist Tom Standage. Mario Batali of White Prosciutto fame has all the tricks for doing Italian conversions on your vegetables. We're talking eating on the cheap with Gourmet Magazine's John Willoughby. He talks inexpensive lamb, what to do with it. Then it's the Happy Belly Guides to Ice Cream. Guru Michael McGarry has picks from across the country, and he's bringing samples. And as always, in the second half of the show, we are going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. Jane, Michael, could we talk your favorite drive-ins?
Well, you know, Lynn, that changes every week, if not every day. But right now, Michael and I are raving about Mug N Bun. Mug apostrophe N Bun.
Okay.
Drive-in in Indianapolis, Indiana. If only for the fact that they serve the most delicious root beer. I mean, you know how when wine lovers say, well, in this glass I taste, you know, a hint of blackberry and poof of rubber tire, or I don't know what the, you know, this, where yeah, I just yeah. taste wine. But anyway, actually, when Michael and I drank the root beer at Mug and Bun, we really detected a smoky hint of vanilla fudge and molasses in it. So we felt very, very sophisticated.
Was there a wonderful aftertaste as well?
We didn't notice the aftertaste because after gulping the root beer, we dug right into our tenderloin sandwiches, which is the other specialty. Note the name of the restaurant is Mug N Bun.
Right.
The mug being
right.
root beer, the bun containing a Midwestern tenderloin, which is deep fried to a crisp.
So this is a drive-in. So this means that they put the tray kind of on the side of the car next to the window, right?
Well,
you have your choice. You can either have in-car dining. You know, you pull up to the order window, place your order in a microphone, and out comes the food on a tray hung on your car window. Or you can sit at a picnic table where they have little buzzers to alert the waitress that you need some help.
Don't you think they should have a buzzer on every restaurant table in the world, everywhere?
That's not a bad idea.
Yeah, I think.
Or a telephone.
A telephone or a light bulb that you can put on or something. I mean, to me, that is total luxury, is to have a buzzer and be able to summon more root beer when you need it.
Are they making the root beer there?
Absolutely. It is made there, and you can get it in sizes that range from small, large to giant, quart, half gallon, and gallon. Now, the latter ones are not served in mugs. I mean, that's to take home. But it is made there on premises. And in fact, we have been told by connoisseurs of Mug and Bun that it varies from time to time. You know, whether you're getting the root beer from the top or bottom of the cask can make a difference. I don't know where we got ours from, but it sure was good.
What about, I mean, is the menu broader than this? What other stuff do they do?
A little bit broader. It's hot dogs, hamburgers. We actually had a double cheeseburger that was terrific. But of course, you know, in central Indiana, the real thing to eat if you're at a drive-in is a tenderloin. I mean, that Hoosier tenderloins are a big deal in that state.
The funniest thing about the pork tenderloins in this part of the country is they're judged on how far the tenderloin meat part extends beyond the bun. You know, you could have a tenderloin the size of a picnic table served to you, it's always going to be on a regulation size hamburger bun. So it kind of looks like a flying saucer.
And there's literally no way to pick it up.
Well, you hold the middle.
How? Who has fingers that big?
With two hands, one on the top, one on the bottom of the bun. And you turn it.
All right, we'll debate this.
You just go on, but thanks a lot.
Nice talking to you, Lynn.
Stick shifts and safety belts, bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving in the car. It makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Shane and Michael Stern are the authors of the updated classic guide, Road Food. Now, you can tune into the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. Now, I have spotted a culinary technique gone astray, and I am here to put it back on track. Now, I'm talking brining, that wonder cure for dry meats and tough cuts. Now, you know the drill. You soak the food in salt water, and the meat cells absorb the salty liquid, and it gets pumped up, so you automatically get juicy tenderness. And you get the bonus. This can stand up to a little overcooking. But people are overdoing it. Now, there's an easy way to sidestep over brining. You brine by thickness. Here's how it works. Anything that's around an inch thick, like pork chops or chicken breasts, brine for 45 minutes to 4 hours. And by the way, you always brine in the refrigerator. Fish is a slightly different deal. Its structure is delicate, so you never brine any fish more than an hour and a half. Whole chicken or Cornish hens, 4 to 8 hours, depending on their size. Turkey, let's say 12 to 18 pounds, brine for 2 days. Roasts, figure 1.5 to 2 hours per inch of thickness. Now, you can find my brine time guide on the website, splendidtable.org. Oh, the redhead with the shorts and the orange sneakers is at it again. He's Chef Mario Batali of Molto Mario fame on the Food Network. Now, I've always loved his food, but I really fell for the man when he told me that at his New York restaurant, Babbo, he was selling his home-cured fatback as white prosciutto. Well, now Mario Batali's got a collection of 10 years of TV recipes. The book is called Molto Italiano. Hey, Mario, it's good to have you back.
Great to be here.
Hey, could we talk Italian vegetables?
Because I think that we should.
You know, I don't think anybody really gets them except the Italians, and they do them like no one else on earth. What do you think is sort of the secret trick that Italy knows that we don't?
Well, Italy understands probably that it's better to buy something in season than something not in season. And the fact that you wouldn't serve strawberry in December or you wouldn't serve asparagus in November is already the first step to understanding how great things can taste.
So I can't have asparagus on my Thanksgiving menu.
You can. And that doesn't make it bad, and it doesn't make you evil. It's just such a different animal to take things out of season and that have been traveling a long ways when you can taste something that was local or at least grown in season somewhere where it's really a specialty.
So it's more about shopping initially.
Well, I would say that is the key to all Italian cooking.
Absolutely.
It's really more about just understanding how easy it is to cook things if you buy the best product that you can find. When Italian grandmothers walk into the produce store, they don't look for the parsley that's 7 cents off because it's 3 days old. They want the best parsley, and there's not that much of a difference in price. It's just a question of a difference in ideology.
What about once you get into the kitchen?
Well, that's where the real game starts. The best thing about the Italian way with vegetables is it's not a technical masterpiece to make something taste really, really good. Often enough, it's just a really hot oven or a really hot pan, and you put things in there with olive oil and a little sea salt, and it tastes, worst case scenario, exactly like it looks. Best case scenario, 10 times more exciting than anything can ever happen, just because it had a development of a caramelization, or it's roasted, or it's spiced in just the right way. Most importantly, you want things to taste like the vegetable itself, with a little bit of anointment.
And the Italians don't cook vegetables the way it's chic to do them here.
No, we do not. It's rare that you will blanch a vegetable, then shock it in water, although sometimes that happens. Cooking green beans, for example, or cooking asparagus, more often than not, Italians just throw it in the pan with olive oil on medium-low heat and cook it until it's cooked all the way through. Not al dente, not super bright green. But when you put it in your mouth and you taste it, it screams green bean.
Yeah, that's the thing I was thinking about, that kind of bringing out every bit of the flavor. Mario, let's get into this book.
Okay.
You have got a ton of vegetable recipes. What are some of your favorites for now?
Some of my favorites for right now are the concha of zucchini, but I also like the verdura in scapece, the pickled vegetables under the antipasti. One of the suspicious and tricky things about Italians' love for vegetables is they often serve them as an antipasto less so than as the side dish to a main course. They love to have three or four different kinds of vegetables before they start anything, and then have a side dish with their main course.
Yeah, yeah. So that they really star. You focus on them in a very different way.
Exactly.
You know, one of the things I think when you talk about zucchini that a lot of people don't realize is that when you brown a zucchini, it changes entirely.
Absolutely.
And do you have any way you like to do that? I mean, do you have a chef's trick?
The main event to getting zucchini really brown is either having a really hot pan or a hot grill, or doing very small batches. If you fry them, if you cut them into little quarters, little thin chips, and you put seven or eight at a time into a pan with a couple tablespoons of extra virgin olive oil and cook them until they almost look too brown.
Mm-hmm.
Take them out. They still seem a little soft. You put them on a little paper towel to kind of drain. And in 3 minutes, you have something nearly as crisp as a potato chip that doesn't taste like that thin white disc was when it was raw. It tastes like the expression of everything that could be right in the summer heat.
Do you do anything with celery?
I love celery. Celery is one of my favorite vegetables, and as it is of the city of Rome, and I'm totally down with the Roman ways, we do it in several ways. Probably my favorite way is fried. We take it and just kind of slice it into little pieces, then we dip it into a little cornstarch and egg, and then put it in extra virgin olive oil, and then just cook it until it's deep, dark, golden brown. It takes on a flavor when it's cooked that way that is spectacular.
How about turnips?
One of the things that is always surprising to a lot of people is the cooking of the different regions, particularly the Northeast and the Southeast in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
And when I think of turnips, I think of the cooking of Friuli, I think of the cooking of Trentino, those very northern, very nearly Austro-Hungarian places. So I like to roast turnips with poppy seeds and paprika and a little bit of vinegar. And they come out so exotic tasting, just from a standard turnip, and you could substitute a beet in there or a rutabaga in the same way, and they come out so good and so delicious and evocative of an Italy that is a different place than when you think about spaghetti, meatballs, and pizza and lasagna.
Yeah, and spices we would never think, or most
right,
people
exactly.
never think of being Italian. Hey, Mario, thank you, love.
My pleasure. I'll always come visit you, Lynn.
You're invited.
Thanks.
Chef Mario Batali's Food Network show is Molto Mario. Now he's celebrating the show's 10th anniversary with a new book, Molto Italiano, 327 Simple Italian Recipes to Cook at Home. Now he left us with that turnip recipe with the paprika and poppy seeds. It's called Pan Roasted Turnips, and it's a great lesson in how Italians slow brown to build up layers of taste. Find it on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, go whole hog. Sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen. Now, every week you get a quick worknight supper recipe along with shopping and technique tips. But best of all, Weeknight Kitchen is free. So sign up at splendidtable.org. Coming up, a history of the world in six glasses, bargain lamb, and trekking across the country with the happy bellies. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/supertarget. In
know the deal about man cannot live on bread alone? Well, British writer Tom Standage takes this much further. He believes that when you look at the past 10,000 or so years, liquid is the tell-all. He says that with six specific liquids, you can chart the flow of world history. Tom is technology editor of Britain's The Economist, and his book is A History of the World in Six Glasses. Tom, welcome.
Hello.
Well, Tom, six liquids, huh?
That's right. They're drinks, and so I'm saying never mind about the Stone Age and the Bronze Age and the Iron Age and stuff like that, and let's instead have the Beer Age and the Wine Age and the Spirits Age. And in fact, we are now living at the end of the Cola Age. So this isn't quite as silly as it sounds, because these drinks align very closely with the dominant historical trends of the eras that they represent, and so you can actually see history through the bottom of a glass.
Well, okay, so now what exactly are they? You've got beer and you've got wine. What else?
Then spirits, then coffee, tea, and cola. So three have alcohol in them, and three have caffeine in them.
Is this the key to the importance? I mean, they're either stimulants or relaxants or whatever. They alter your state, I guess. Is that the
key? Yes, I think that's a big part of it. Another thing is that they're all safer alternatives to water. So when water is contaminated, which it very often was in history, it made a lot more sense to drink beer or wine or spirits. And then later on, you have these caffeinated alternatives. And the switch from alcohol to caffeine had an obvious sobering effect. And it meant that there was this great sort of intellectual flourishing in the 17th century, for example, when coffee appears in Europe, because instead of drinking alcohol at breakfast, people can now have a caffeinated drink, which gets you going instead of sort of putting you to sleep. And so as early as 1660, people are saying this coffee drink has had a great effect on the sobriety of nations and this sort of thing. And they're already denouncing beer as foggy ale that besieges our minds, and wine as a drink that robs us of reason. So it was very clear that coffee and other caffeinated drinks that came after it had this sort of enlivening effect on culture.
But, you know, it's interesting because you say wine was used by the Greeks in what they called symposiums to open the mind to the intellect, to open the mind to creativity.
Yes, but the Greeks drank wine in a very specific way. They diluted it with water.
Uh-huh.
And the idea was that you had to get the balance exactly right. And wine was all about balance. In fact, Aeschylus says bronze is the mirror of the outward form, the mirror of the body.
Right.
And wine is the mirror of the mind. And Plato writes about wine as the ideal way to test someone's character. So he says, you know, if someone wants to marry into your family, then, you know, a very good way to test their character is through their attitude to wine. Because the Greeks despised people who didn't drink alcohol at all. They said they were only good for looking after children. And they also despised barbarians who drank wine undiluted. The crucial thing was to be at exactly the right point in the middle, and to dilute the wine and to drink the wine in the right way, so that you had this sort of freedom of tongue, but you weren't actually incoherent and on the floor. So wine was a sort of test of your character.
Well, it may still be. Yeah. Now, the other thing that surprised me is that you say that distillation, the making of alcohol, was perfected by Arab scholars. And I'm thinking, you know, traditionally, isn't alcohol forbidden in Arab culture? And you say that essentially you have to go back to Cordoba in Spain in 1000 AD to understand
this. Yes. Yes, absolutely. I mean, it is a great irony that distillation is perfected by Arabs who are actually, because they're Muslims, they're forbidden to drink alcohol themselves. But that's because distillation was a scientific, medicinal, alchemical process. And the result, aqua vitae, as it was called in Europe, was regarded as a sort of miracle cure. But yes, at the time when distillation was being perfected, I mean, it was vaguely known to the Greeks, but it was the Arabs who really figured it out. At that point, of course, it was the height of Arab civilization. And the Arab Empire was actually larger than the Roman Empire was at its height. And at this point, the Western European nations were languishing in the depths of what are sometimes called the Dark Ages.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, meanwhile, let's say over in Cordoba, I mean, it was called the jewel of the world. It was an amazing place. It had an enormous library containing 500,000 books, which was probably more books than all the rest of the Western nations put together. It had 700 mosques, 300 public baths. It had street lighting. having parks, palaces and paved roads. I mean, this was absolutely, you know, the place to be, whereas London was absolutely, you know, a slum at that point. Anyway, so out of this Arab culture comes the distillation. And once the Western Europeans get hold of it, yes, they use the distilled drinks first as a medicine, but then it becomes this drink that can absolutely lay you out flat. And this becomes extremely important during the age of exploration, because it's a way of packing alcohol into a small space, and that's exactly what you want on board ship. And of course, distilled drinks don't spoil in the way that beer and wine do if you take them on a long journey. So so once again, you get this alignment between a historical period and a particular drink.
Well, you've got six liquids. What do you think in the future is going to be the seventh liquid?
Well, it's very clear what it is. It's going to be water. Water was the first drink to steer the course of human progress, because bands of hunter-gatherers had to stay near sources of fresh water. And then all of these other drinks throughout history were really alternatives to water. They were they had stimulant properties. They were safer than water most of the time. And so in large part, the return of water to the driving seat of history is a good thing, because it means that the unsafe water of the past has been banished. For those of us in the rich world, we have safe tap water coming into our homes, and this is a great achievement. In the last 150 years or so, we figured out why water used to be unsafe, and for the last 10,000 years, and now we have nice safe tap water. The strange thing is, most people don't want to drink it; they want to drink bottled water instead. Even though most bottled water is in fact tap water that's just been filtered and put into bottles, and costs thousands of times more than tap water, and it really doesn't make any sense. So, what's particularly strange about all of this is that people in the developing world don't have safe access to water. In many cases, there's over a billion people who still don't. And yet those of us who do have access to safe tap water are choosing not to drink it. And I think this is rather silly.
We are very complicated beings. Tom, thank you.
Thank you.
Tom Standage is technology editor of Britain's The Economist. His book is A History of the World in Six Glasses. John Willoughby is executive editor of Gourmet Magazine, an award-winning food writer, a grilling expert, and a guy who knows his meats, which is why I'd like to talk with him today. Summer is lamb season, but those $15 a pound chops tend to hold you back. Hey, John, welcome back.
It's great to be here, Lynn.
John, what's your take on cheap cuts of lamb? What do you like?
Cheap cuts of lamb.
Yeah.
Well, I think the primary source for cheap cuts of lamb, and my absolute favorite part of the lamb, is the shoulder. It's much like the chuck in a beef in that it has more flavor than most other parts of the animal. It is a little tougher, of course, than the pricier cuts, but it does have that better flavor. And because lamb are brought to market so young, it is much more tender than you might think if you were comparing it to beef chuck.
Now, is that word going to be, because I don't see that word often on a package in the supermarket. Shoulder, I mean.
Well, you don't, because the cuts are not that popular. They've sort of gotten a bad reputation. But I think the more we start looking for them and buying them, the more they'll start appearing. For example, my personal favorite cut of lamb is the shoulder arm chop, which is a chop that costs about a quarter of what a loin chop will cost.
Mm-hmm.
And it has some fat and some bones in it, but it's got amazing lamb flavor. And because of the nature of the shoulder, you can grill it or you can braise it. And any chop you see, there are two main kinds of shoulder lamb chops. There's the blade chop and the arm chop. But mostly they just label them shoulder chops, so you can't really be too sure which one you're getting, but they're both great.
How do you like to prepare them?
Well, the shoulder chops, I basically grill, and they can take a lot of strong flavors, too, because they've got that deep, rich lamb flavor.
Mm-hmm.
And another way to use the shoulder, in addition to the chops, is in kebabs. People usually think of having a cut-up lamb leg for kebabs, mm-hmm. but again, the shoulder has more flavor. And if you just buy a shoulder roast and cut it up yourself, you get an amazing value for the money. And another option, and this is one that I really have come to love in the last week, and that is the shoulder roast. Again, you don't often see them, but if you ask a butcher for them, you can get them, and they are starting to appear in supermarkets. The boneless shoulder roast is the easiest to deal with. And they are, again, they are amenable to braising, moist cooking, but they're also tender enough to just roast. So they're very versatile. They are a little bit chewy compared to the leg, but they have, again, really great flavor. And we have been working in the test kitchens at Gourmet on perhaps my favorite recipe of the year so far, which is a roasted lamb shoulder in a spiced yogurt sauce with clarified butter.
Oh,
and
boy.
You roast it for 3 or 4 hours. In a little liquid, and then you put in this clarified butter for the last hour. You add a spiced yogurt sauce for the last about half hour, and you serve it with pine nuts and onions that have been cooked in that same clarified butter.
Oh,
it's like,
boy,
it's
that
falling
good.
Off the bone. It's so rich. They've tested it maybe 6 times, and I think they have to test it 8 or 10 more to perfect it.
Yeah, you really want to get it right.
To make me happy.
Yeah. Any bargains to be had on the other end of the lamb? I mean, we're working the front end.
We're working the front end hard, but there are some cuts from the leg, and one in particular that are a good deal, and it's called a sirloin steak. And what it is from the blade, from the top end of the leg, they very often cut off 3 or 4 steaks about, half an inch or 3/4 inch thick before they package the leg as a roast. And they're called sirloin steaks because they are exactly this equivalent of the sirloin in the cow. And these are, again, quite cheap, and they're even less fatty and they have less toughness than the shoulders. So if you can find the sirloin lamb steaks, they are an amazing bargain.
This is great. We can really save some money. Hey, John, thank you.
You're very welcome.
John Willoughby is author of Let the Flames Begin. You can get John's recipe for grilled lamb shoulder chops Greek style on the website, splendidtable.org. Well, there's a new collection of guidebooks. They're called the Happy Belly Guides. Their first publications are a collection of ice cream guides called Scoops. Each one covers a different American region, and then there's one on Italy. Well, the mind behind Happy Bellies is Michael McGarry, and Michael joins us in the studio. Michael, good to have you here.
Thanks, Lynn. Thanks for having me.
All right, Michael, now, as a professional, how do you check out an ice cream place?
Well, I have a couple different rules that I go by. First, I let good ice cream find me. if I'm ever on the street and I see a significant amount of people with cones in hand, I make sure to follow that line of cones to its source. Because usually if a lot of people are smiling and walking with ice cream, that means that there's going to be good ice cream at the store that's serving it.
Mm-hmm.
After that, I'll walk in. The first thing I do is smell. If you can smell freshly baked waffle cones, that's a good sign that the ice cream there is going to be delicious. Any store that takes the time to bake their own ice cream cones usually takes the time to make great ice cream. After that, I make sure there's flyers on the walls. Hopefully, a place will have pictures drawn by little kids hanging there. That always means a good kind of community's vibe is at the store. And then I'll actually look at the flavors. Make sure there's no, ice crystals on top. That means it's being refrozen and the turnover isn't good enough.
Mm-hmm.
But my big test is the banana test. I look at the banana, and if it's bright yellow right there, that's a huge warning sign. That means that they're using artificial flavorings and sweeteners rather than using fresh banana. Ice cream shouldn't be too pretty. It can be a tad ugly, and banana, when done right, is a tad ugly. It's kind of muted, and so that means they're using the freshest flavors possible.
Everything you said, I'm thinking, yeah, I think I remember that. Yeah, that makes sense. I would have never thought of that banana thing as the giveaway.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes a lot of sense because so many ice creams look like they're day glow.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. You've covered the entire country and you also went to Italy for these guides. What do you see happening on the scene for American ice cream?
There's a couple different trends. One, as a writer of a gelato guide, I'm happy to see that gelato is making inroads here in the States almost everywhere, especially on the coasts.
Mm-hmm.
I just got back from a trip to New York where I was lucky enough to go to Otto Anateca Pizzeria, Mario Batali's restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
And he employs a pastry chef, Meredith Kurtzman, who has access to the most expensive ingredients in the world. And Mario just wants her to make the best gelato in the world. So she'll make this delicious olive oil gelato that has these veins of olive oil flowing through it and then sprinkled with sea salt. Another flavor I tried was saffron with currants, which, you know, saffron's very pricey, but I mean, it had a spark to it that really brought out both flavors. Another trend that I'm seeing is the artisanal movement has really hit the States in ice cream production as well. We're talking about people who search for a perfect base. They'll have it shipped hours. Mallard Ice Cream in Bellingham, Washington, mm-hmm. which is about 2 hours north of Seattle, they ship their base from Oregon because...
Now, when you say base, do you mean the custard or the flavoring?
The cream base that everything starts with.
Uh-huh.
You know, he'll taste 30 different bases before he decides on this. Here in Minnesota, Crema Cafe, they tasted 25 different types of chocolate before they found their ultimate chocolate ice cream, which... has three different chocolates in it, and it's just fabulous.
Well, you know, not to be pushy, but you arrived with a cooler, and have you got stuff to taste?
I do. I have.
What have you got?
One of my favorite parlors is Jenny's Fresh Ice Cream from Columbus, Ohio.
Uh huh.
And she is just a real ice cream artisan. I brought for you a salty caramel, which is her specialty. And this is made with, you know, plugra butter, a little sea salt, and it's
this thing about salt with sweet, the olive oil, which sounds weird, I know, to a lot of people, mm-hmm. but I've had olive oil sweets, and they're incredible. Salty caramel. Can we taste it now?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, because I have this bowl in front of me, guys. You see, and I'm, you know, I'm sitting here watching this, and now, as a pro, do you want it to have a little melt around the scoop? I mean, is that, because I always thought that was kind of great.
Definitely. Okay. You definitely do not want it hard. You want it to just kind of dissolve in your mouth once it gets there.
The salty caramel is unbelievable.
It is. It's
salty and it's caramel. But it doesn't hit you over the head. I mean, it's sweet too, and it's very creamy.
Just the reading some names of her other flavors. I mean, she has Thai chili, cocoa zin. I mean, she's really just bringing in all types of ingredients because she works in a farmer's market. So she just sees what's fresh or what, you know, the local spice market has in mm-hmm. stock, and she'll incorporate it into an ice cream.
How long has she been doing this?
She's been making ice cream for 10 years, but Jenny's has only been in existence for 3. So
she was sort of in training.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, what else did you bring?
Well, I don't want to sound like, you know, ice cream's all gelato or artisan ice cream these
right.
days. There's also amazing parlors throughout the country that have been around for 100 years, like a Grater's in Cincinnati. But I brought today Kopp's Custard from Milwaukee. In a land where cheese curds roam free and sour cream flows from the tap, you know, Kopp's Custard has really reached a high status. And I think their vanilla is the best in the country, actually.
So that's what the other thing is
yes.
in the bowl here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's see. Let's see what this is. Because vanilla, is vanilla the test?
Vanilla for me, for custard, definitely is the test.
Oh. I'm sorry.
Are we going to need
I'm
to stop?
I'm out of here. Give me the whole container. I'll take the pint, and you can talk to the folks. Boy, is that good.
It's almost like a mother's milk. I mean, it really is just so pure
no memory,
and creamy.
But, you know, it's just great. This is so it is the test. Vanilla is the test with a frozen custard.
It really is. Just straight from the machine.
Michael, this is utterly fabulous. And I really thank you. This is, you've made my day in many ways.
Thank you, Lynn. Enjoy.
Michael McGarry is editor and co-author of the Happy Belly Guides. Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what drink was necessary to build an empire? Now, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by SuperTarget, home of Archer Farms, where you can find new takes on ethnic classics like salsa, chorizo, and black beans. Find them online at target.com/SuperTarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what drink was necessary to build an empire? Well, the drink was the gin and tonic, and it was first created when the sun never set on the British Empire in the mid-1800s. It's the drink of the Raj and all those old un-PC movies of white hunters and jungle plantations. Now, malaria was the big problem for the British in their tropical possessions, especially in India. Quinine was the right medicine, but the challenge was how to get soldiers to take the nasty stuff. Quinine is the bitter extract taken from the bark of a tree. Well, gin made it go down quicker, and it was also thought to be a medicine in itself. Now, when the Schweppes people came along and mixed quinine with sugar and bubbly water, the gin and tonic was born. The lines are officially open. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's see. Let's get right to it. We have got Annie on the line from Seattle. Hey, Annie, what do you want to talk about?
I'm interested in finding out how to make the perfect Cuban sandwich. There's a little restaurant in Seattle that makes these wonderful sandwiches with caramelized onions, and it's like a pork tenderloin that's pounded and grilled. But they marinate it in something for 24 hours, and I haven't figured out how to do the marinade.
Does the sandwich you like have cheese in it?
No, it's probably not really authentic Cuban, but
right.
It's like a French roll, and it's got a little like a mayonnaise sauce, but there's something more to the sauce.
Uh-huh.
And then a pork tenderloin that's been grilled, and then caramelized onions and lettuce. It's so good.
Oh, Lord, it sounds fabulous. You know what I'm wondering? When you do Cuban sandwiches, there's this slow-cooked pork that's done with it. It's sort of roasted, braised. And if I remember correctly, it's marinated in bitter orange juice, which is to be had in the Caribbean, but it would be OJ with lime and garlic and I think black pepper. And I wonder if that's not close. Oh, and olive oil. I wonder if they're not doing that with the pork tenderloin. Does it have any sense of orange to it? Or
yeah, it does have a little bit of a sweet, but it's also, it seems like it's got some more spices.
Okay, this is what I would try, all right? I would do, for argument's sake, all right, quarter cup of olive oil,
okay,
half cup of really tasty orange juice, a couple of tablespoons of fresh lime juice, you know, just squeeze half a lime into it.
Okay.
Add a little bit of hot chili, like a little cayenne or Tabasco.
Okay.
Black pepper and some garlic, a couple of cloves of garlic.
Okay.
And slice up the pork tenderloin, pound it, and put it in that for about a half hour. You could leave it a little longer, but you don't want to get it to the point where it's tough from all the acid. And then I try grilling it.
Okay.
And I think for the fun of it, for the mayonnaise, add a little lime to the mayonnaise and a little bit of garlic. Just see if that does it for you.
All right, I will definitely try it.
And whatever they call it, it sounds like a great sandwich. Guess what we're going to eat this weekend? Hey, Annie, thanks.
All right, thank you very much.
Goodbye.
Bye.
It does sound like a dynamite sandwich. Call us, guys, 800-537-5252. Now, we have Kevin on the line calling from Portland, Oregon. Hey, Kevin, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi, how are you?
I am good.
Well, I work at a restaurant in Portland, and it's a vegetarian restaurant.
Uh-huh.
We serve French fries, but they never seem to come out quite right. And, you know, they're either too limp or they're not done all the way. We've tried a par fry, but they always come out, you know, kind of limp.
Uh-huh.
We've tried soaking them in salt water, and they're just not done all the way through. Do you have any tips on making a good French fry?
First of all, what kind of potato are you using?
We're using russets.
Okay. The key to a great French fry, a couple of keys. One key is the potato has to be as dry as possible. So the older the potato is, I don't mean going bad, but a more, shall we say, mature potato, like an Idaho Baker or the russet that you're using, the better. Because as a potato sits around, it loses moisture. And then the other thing that you want to do is you do a double fry. And this is what I'm remembering. I lived in Belgium for a while where, personally, between me and thee, they make the best French fries in the whole world. They should be called Belgian fries because they eat far more fries per capita than anybody in France ever dreamed of. And there are fry stands everywhere. And the deal was these more mature potatoes that were drier. And the thing was you'd cut them and then you'd drop them in oil that was 350 degrees.
Yeah. Exactly what our oil is.
Right. Now, your potato may be too moist. That may be one of the problems. Obviously, now that you know dry is important, never soak it in salt water.
Okay.
Yeah, because, it just keeps absorbing. But what you want to do is you're doing that first step just to cook it through. It's not going to get brown. You know that. I mean, it's just going to gradually pick up color.
Yeah.
And you do that for maybe 5-6 minutes. You pull that out. Really let it drain. And then when you're ready to actually serve it, because you can do that a bit ahead, what you do is you do it at 375 to 380, and that second fry is going to give it the crisp brownness.
Huh, great.
Hopefully this is going to work.
Well, our par fry, we usually, do it at 350 for a couple minutes, and then when we're ready to serve it, it's still at 350.
No, that's the key. You got to get it crisp.
Even hotter than that.
Yeah, because as you par fry it, what's actually happening is it helps it stay nice and light and fluffy, and it's cooking it through. So don't keep it at 350. Flip it up. No higher than 380, though.
Okay.
Well, okay?
Try it. Hey, thanks a lot. Have a good day.
You too, and thank you.
Yeah,
Take care. You know, nobody can resist great French fries. And the idea that you fry it twice means that you can really do most of the frying ahead. And then you can serve them at the last minute by just dropping them in that fat that's up to 380. Call us, 800-537-5252. Let's see, who's up next? We have Kate calling from Manhattan Beach in California. Hey, Kate, what do you want to talk about?
I have this beautiful fig tree that is producing an abundance of fruit this year. What I normally do is I usually put a little cheese in them, wrap them in prosciutto, and barbecue them.
That sounds pretty swell.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Or I will spear them with a little bit of rosemary and bake them. And both of those are good. But I have so many coming this year that I was wondering if you have any ideas for me of some new things I could try. And also, if you could tell me how I would dry them for later use.
Okay. Let's do the last thing first.
Okay.
All right. For drying, you could do it outside on a screen. You'd split it in half.
Okay.
And you'd let it be out in the sun. At night, you'd pull it in. But the other way to dry it is in a very low oven. Split them in half, put them on a rack over a pan, put them in like a 150-degree oven and let them go, or 180-degree oven, and let them go for about 12, 14 hours.
Okay.
There's a couple of tricks. One of the great classics in southern Italy, not just in southern Italy, all over Italy, is that the dried figs or the fresh figs, you split them in half and you sprinkle some aniseed mm-hmm. over the flesh, and you can dry them with that in it. Or you just take the fresh figs and then you put a almond over that. Put the two pieces of the fig together and bake it slowly in the oven on a bed of bay leaves. And they are just unbelievable. I mean, you can serve those with meat. You can serve those with drinks. You can put them out for dessert with a little, ice cream. And they're fabulous. Along that idea, another fun thing to do as a condiment, for meats and stuff, why not roll them in brown sugar, okay, and hot chili and fresh thyme, and then grill them, but hot, 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 hot. Or under the broiler in the oven. You just want them bubbling and searing on the outside with caramelized sugar, but still juicy on the inside. And then think of that as, it's almost like a chutney in one sense. And you've got the heat and the sweet and the whole deal. So that's another idea.
Sounds good.
Yeah. The other thing is, we had Ben and Jerry on quite a while ago, and they talked about the simplest way to do ice cream. You need an ice cream maker, but puree of fruit, in your case, the figs, with whatever spiking you want. With figs, I'd always do a little bit of lemon or orange rind just because I think they like that, And then milk and cream, half and half, half milk, half cream, sugar to taste, a little more than you would normally use because when you freeze stuff, you know, it mutes flavor.
Yeah.
And throw them in the ice cream machine.
Oh, my gosh, that sounds good.
Doesn't that sound like, I mean, that it's got, I mean, let's put it this way. The worst thing that happens is it's crystallized and it's lumpy and it's chunky and it's still the best thing you've put in your mouth probably all week.
Right.
And
right.
And also the good news there is you can stick it in the freezer for a month or two and you'll at least, you know, be storing away some of those figs. And you know, that's the other thing is freeze the figs.
Right.
Freeze them and then, you know, put them on a cookie sheet or whatever so that they freeze individually, pop them into plastic bags and then use them as a sauce, you know, or use them squishy. Sprinkling them with some herbs or some, you know, sweet stuff or like, you know, the inside of a vanilla bean.
Right.
And that's, and I just can imagine that melting away in your mouth. And then the last thing, when in doubt, always stick them in brandy. And next year you'll have holiday gifts.
Nothing bad about that either. Huh?
Yeah. I mean, I just went down into the basement and I found a 10-year-old jar of cherries in booze. And I can't tell you how good the booze was. I almost didn't make it back upstairs. You know, this is one of the best ways they've been preserving stuff in alcohol, you know, donkey's ages. And you'll love it when it gets to be somewhere around November or December.
Sounds great.
Hey, thanks.
All right. Thanks a lot, Lynn.
You are welcome.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Talk about getting on a roll. Anyway, 800-537-5252. We have Lois calling from Manchester, Vermont. Hey, Lois, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about bread boxes.
Bread boxes?
Yeah. I've always had, well, for one thing, like, I'm either putting bread in the refrigerator or the freezer, and I'm sick and tired of it. And, like, I can't understand the science of a bread box. Why should it keep bread fresher longer or, you know, or does it?
Well, first of all, I think it probably goes back to the time when either people didn't have refrigeration.
Right.
And it kept the bugs away. You know,
right.
that was, I think, the deal. And, you know, in old houses, you'll even find kitchen drawers with sliding metal
That's
tops.
Right.
It's like the bread drawer.
Right. They still do it today. Yeah.
But I think there's something here that has a little bit of science to it, too, because food scientists tell me that when you chill bread, there is a change in the starch structure and the bread gets wetter.
Uh-huh.
And the crust isn't all that great. Now, mm-hmm. you can crisp it in an oven and you're fine. Mm-hmm. But that, you know, if you go to Europe, mm-hmm. bread is usually kept at room temperature. It's either in a box or
right.
it's in a sack.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea is the bread's supposed to get drier because,
right.
you know, each stage of that bread going stale, there are uses for it, you know, soup and, right. and bruschetta and all that other stuff.
Right.
I mean, I now keep my bread in a sack that hangs off of a hook in the kitchen.
You do?
Yeah. It's a very, I have to tell you, I mean, this is a very classy sack from Italy, and it says pane.
Right. Uh-huh.
And
yeah.
And the other thing is, I think it keeps the bread away from light. But if I go into an artisanal bakery, 90% of the time, all the cut loaves are cut side down on a board. They're not in a bag. They're not, you know, nobody's putting them in plastic.
Right.
So I think it's that the bread tastes better. It's going to go stale faster, but that's okay. You know?
It'll still go stale faster. Right, but it won't get the mold?
No, it won't because okay. you've got air circulating.
Right. Uh-huh.
So?
Yeah. I will probably invest in one.
You know, first of all, where do you live?
Vermont.
Ah, hey, get an old one. You know, I mean, think something very classy and very, very, you know, funky. It could be great on the counter.
Right, right, yeah. Okay.
Hey.
All right. Well,
thank you
so much.
You are welcome.
Okay, bye-bye.
Take care. You can call us at 800-537-5252. We've got Stephen calling from Minneapolis. Hey, Stephen, what do you want to talk about?
Hi. I wanted to talk about huitlacoche.
Corn smut. Yeah. The most unattractive name for a food to come down the pike in ages.
Yeah, that's why I thought the Aztec name might be a better starter. I opened up with corn smut. I thought you might not want to talk to me at all.
No, because I happen to be a fan of corn smut. But I think a lot of people hear corn smut, and boy, is that's a hard sell.
I'll say.
I gather you like it?
Well, you know what? I haven't tried it yet, so I would call you to ask you about
it. Okay, why don't we explain to everybody what it is? This is actually, and I'm not going to get the science right about it, no doubt, but this is a mold or a fungus that develops within the kernel of corn. And it happens a great deal in Mexico where it's treasured. It's, as you said, it probably goes back to the Aztecs as long as there's been corn. And it's really almost like a corn mushroom. That may be a more appealing way to describe it. And when it's sort of fully ripe, it's sort of a purplish, gray color. It is not pretty, but it has a delicious, delicate, slightly sweet flavor. And living in Minneapolis, believe it or not, because there has been a significant Mexican population, you may be able to find that it's brought in fresh occasionally. It comes canned. I don't think the canned one is anywhere near as good as the fresh. But think of a mushroom. And anything you would do with a mushroom, you would do with huitlacoche. And what they do in Mexico is often it will be sautéed perhaps with a bit of chili and onion. It will go into a tamale or be rolled up in a tortilla. Rick Bayless. Have you ever heard of Rick Bayless?
He's there. I have.
Yeah. Now, he's done a couple of books, and he talks about it at length. And his recipes are great.
And I've seen it mentioned in Diana Kennedy as well.
Yes, exactly. Two great sources. But at his restaurant, Topolobampo, in Chicago, Rick did this incredible thing where he sautéed the corn smut the way you would do mushrooms, with a little salt and pepper, and I think he had a little bit of garlic. And then he made a custard. In so many words, he took little custard cups, and you do this thing where for every egg you have a half a cup of cream or milk or half and half.
Uh-huh.
And he seasoned the custard with cinnamon and salt and pepper, if I remember correctly. And he put the huitlacoche at the bottom of the little ramekins, and then he poured in the custard and he put it in a water bath and he baked it. And he served that. I think it even had a tad of sugar in it. It was fabulous. And the only thing I would add to it is fresh sweet corn or defrosted, good-tasting frozen corn. And if you make like a corn pudding and put sautéed huitlacoche in it and bake it in the oven, you will think you've died and gone to heaven.
Wow.
Other than that, I have nothing to say about it.
Okay, marvelous.
Hey,
well,
thank you.
I'll report back to you after I've experimented.
Okay, please
great.
Do. Okay,
thank
Steve?
You so much, and I love your show.
Hey, thank you.
You bet.
Bye. Well, that's the show for this week, guys. Thanks for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. That number again, 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this travel advice from Charles Kuralt. He said you can find your way across the country using burger joints the way navigators use stars. The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. Register for it online, splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rosetta Pasper.
American Public Media.